Mr. Chairman, thank you very much indeed for those kind reminiscences of my previous life. I recognise some of them, I think. And also thank you very much to the Global Strategy Forum for having invited me to speak to you today. For somebody from my background, it's always a pleasure to talk about Brazil, because when one's been in a country like that, which is exciting, one ends up being passionate about it to a degree. But I have to admit that there is one sort of hesitation about talking about Brazil in this country, which is that Brazil is a country which the United Kingdom was engaged with very deeply in the 19th century, and then we managed to forget about it basically for 100 years, most of the 20th century, and only recovered an interest in the last 20 years, say. And so I have this problem that the level of familiarity with Brazil when one talks to British audiences is relatively low on average, and yet I know that here within the audience there are some people who know the country extremely well. So I crave indulgence. I will try not to insult the knowledge or the intelligence of those of you who know Brazil rather well, while also trying to come down to some basics and some fundamentals which I hope will support the argument that I'm trying to make about Brazil's progress so far and the mainstream of argumentation, which is really the question, which is the title of the lecture, is Brazil a future global power? So again, I will leave lots of things out, but I will try and concentrate on that. I thought it might be helpful to structure at least the first part of what I'm going to say to you by putting forward and addressing three propositions. None of them particularly staggering, but I hope they will set a basis for what I then want to say after that. The three propositions are the following, and then I will talk about each of them. The first one is that Brazil's size, her natural endowments, and bits of her history actually predispose it to be a big player once we have a globalised world. In other words, scale in a globalised world to a degree matters. That's the first one. I'll come back to it. Secondly, and perhaps slightly more surprising, I don't know, is the proposition that for Brazil, it's a bit more natural, if you're going to be a major player in the world, in a globalised world, to be a global power rather than a regional power. And I will try and explain that a bit later on. And thirdly, as a matter of more historical fact, the proposition that Brazil has indeed long aspired to major power status of one type or another. So let me address those before trying then to go on and saying, okay, but predisposition and aspiration is not actually enough to create a great power. They may actually need other things, such as a bit of underlying substance and opportunity, not to say luck. So that will be the second half of what I want to talk about. So if we look at that first of those three propositions, Brazil's size, natural endowments and history predispose it in some sense, once we have a globalised world, to be a big player in that. In other words, scale matters. And scale is always one of those difficult things, and it's one of those things, as ambassador in Brazil, I always had to make sure that visitors, either coming from other South American countries or coming from this country, actually had an appreciation of the scale of what they are dealing with. And this gives me a chance to roll out a whole load of statistics, which are very basic, but I hope will actually define a little bit the nature of what we are talking about. And we are indeed talking about, in terms of geographical area, the fifth largest country in the world. Russia, Canada, China and the US are somewhat bigger, but Brazil is geographically bigger than Australia. It is of continental size, and if you lop off Alaska from the US, it's actually bigger than continental US. So this is not a small country in South America of insignificant size. Partly along with that, but and not so not so startling, perhaps. It's also the fifth largest, fifth most populous country in the world. China, India, the US, and Indonesia are larger in terms of population, but we have a population at the moment of 190 million people. Pretty significant. It's a true $2 trillion economy at the moment. It's always been quite a big economy, but at the moment it's over $2 trillion. Currently, about seventh in global rankings, soon to be fifth, soon to leap over France and the UK, and to be behind only the US, China, Japan, and Germany. That's in terms of market values. If you do it in terms of PPP values, Brazil is much the same, but actually India comes up very substantially. So economic, geographical and economic scale is there. Let me just talk a little bit about natural endowment. Minerals first. I mean, Brazil is the largest producer of iron ore in the world. It's got huge untapped reserves of uranium. It's a large producer of alumina. It had a gold rush of significant proportions in the 18th century, which enriched the Portuguese treasury, rather. It has all kinds of diamonds, gems, lots of gemstones, which you haven't seen, you can't see anywhere else. And now it has very, very significant reserves of oil and gas offshore, which are in the process of being exploited. And I think the interesting fact about all that stuff is that at the same time, the statement is that only about 15% of that huge land area has actually been properly geologically prospected to more than 100 metres of depth. So you say to yourselves, what else is there out there which they're going to discover, and what is the potential in terms of natural resources, in terms of minerals? And while we're talking about that kind of endowment, one has to think of not just the minerals commodity side, but also the agricultural commodity side, where Brazil is already a huge superpower in terms of scale. They currently cultivate something like 60 million hectares of land, and with that, they are either the largest producer or the largest exporter, depending on the commodity, of beef, chicken, coffee, sugar, orange juice. The list goes on and on. Not quite so good in pig meat, but not bad. And then you realise that they're doing that from 60 million hectares of cultivable land. They've actually got another 120 million hectares of cultivable land, which is not cultivated. So the potential is incredible. And the big thing that they have, which a lot of others don't have, is they've got water. Plenty of water. Fresh water. Indeed, I think the statistic is that 28% of the world's flows of fresh water flow down the Amazon. So they have, sort of, if you like, at their disposal, a commodity which is going to become incredibly important, both economically and also probably strategically, in the year ahead. And having mentioned the Amazon, I've got, of course, to mention that they have the largest expanse of tropical forest, and along with that, they are a mega-diverse, biodiverse country. Not just the Amazon, but equally biodiverse is the plateau lands, the so-called Cerrado in Brazil, which is actually where some of this large expanse of agricultural land is. Enough of natural heritage. Let me just talk about two facts of history, which I think are important for this sort of predisposition to be a great power. First of that is that Brazil, and here contrast it with China, India, other countries, if you will, is fundamentally an immigrant country. The indigenous population is now tiny. It was effectively wiped out in the colonial era. But actually that means that one of the things it means is that they have natural connections through that immigrant population to Europe, to Africa, the slave trade. Many people don't know that seven times as many slaves were imported into Brazil in Portuguese times as into the US. Stunning, absolutely stunning figure. And also populations, Middle East immigrant populations, which gives them a natural connections to that. So although they have had periods in their history when they've been very inward-looking, there is also channels to the outside. And the second fact of history, which I'll just mention in this context, is really that unlike the rest of South America, Spanish South America, they had a very peaceful transition to interdependence, into independence, which didn't actually cause a huge rupture with the European colonizing state, in this case Portugal. So I think those things just hold in the back of your mind as we come to look at Brazil a little later on. Now, the second of the propositions I wanted to put before you was that it was perhaps more natural for Brazil to think of itself, if it's going to become a major power, as a global rather than a regional power. There's a very interesting and very comprehensive article by Leslie Bethell. I don't know if any people know about him. Now retired, but the preeminent British historian of Brazil, which he published last year in the Journal of Latin American Studies, which makes a very compelling argument that historically Brazil maintained closer ties to Europe, initially Portugal, subsequently in the 19th century, both the UK and France, and significant ties to the US, which both of which were actually much closer than the ties which Brazil had to the rest of Latin America. And indeed, for most of its independent history, the Brazilians did not think of themselves as part of Latin America. As far as they were concerned, Latin America was Hispanic America, and they were something different. It's only in about the last 20 years that Brazil has engaged seriously with its neighbours, and the sphere of neighbours which it has chosen to engage with is not Latin America or Latin America and the Caribbean, for political and other reasons. Mexico is a bit difficult for them. It's actually South America. Hence the concentration on Mercosur, the common market of the southern cone. More recently, of UNASUR, which is the United Nations of South America. Started off as the Community of South American Nations, a sort of incipient defense council of the countries of South America generated by the Brazilians. And this concentration on South America rather than Latin America is partly for, as I said, for political reasons. It's got partly economic advantages, that is their natural economic hinterland. It's a huge expansion of their already very large home market. But they also see it in strategic terms as, if you like, consolidating the regional base on which to build a much greater power projection, if you like, in the world. So it is for them a step towards global influence rather than the determining fact itself. And you've only got to think in terms of the votes that they would like to garner to become a permanent member of the UN Security Council as an obvious example of that. So that's the second proposition I wanted to put before you. And the third one was that Brazil has actually aspired for a long time to major power status of one kind or another. And I'm sorry if this is a lesson in history, but there's a little bit of few nuggets along the way which I think are quite interesting. By coincidence, quite a lot of this has actually been collected in an article which should be published about now, which I've authored in the Diplomatic Courier, which is a Washington-based periodical. In a sense, the most trivial example of aspirations to be to be a major power, but also sort of perhaps indicative, dates actually from the moment of Brazilian independence in 1822, when they declared themselves independent from the Portuguese Empire, because the chap who was subsequently king refused to go back to Portugal, as his father told him to. And they didn't declare themselves the Brazilian kingdom, they declared themselves to be the Brazilian Empire. Not much substance behind it, except being a big place, because at that time they were increasingly part of the sort of British imperial system, the British imperial orbit in South America. But still, it was there, that kind of interesting aspiration. Fast forward 100 years, and you get to 1928, after 100 years of sort of national consolidation. 1928. Brazil was already a well-respected member, but a non-permanent member, of the Council of the League of Nations. The Locarno Treaty had just been signed, across there in the Foreign Office. And the central element of that, or one central element of that, was admission of Germany to the League of Nations. And the price of that was that a permanent seat for Germany should be created on the Council. This was part of the deal. Two countries who stood out against that were Spain and Brazil, very interestingly. Brazil said in particular, fine, we'll agree to that, but we want a permanent seat for us as well. And it's a very interesting little bit of history, because they said, and all the Latin Americans support us, and within a few days it became absolutely clear that Latin Americans didn't support them at all. They disavowed that, they resiled from that. But the Brazilians took it to the extent that they resigned from the League of Nations, and they never came back over that particular issue. They resigned in 1929. The next iteration of this little story was, I guess, 1945, not so much a Brazilian instigation, but actually an American instigation with Brazilian acquiescence, when at the Dumbarton Oaks conference, the Americans actually put forward, and this apparently came from Roosevelt himself, that the Brazilians should be a permanent member of the new UN organization, well, the UN, which was being discussed there. This was an idea which was dumped on pretty quickly by both the Brits and the Russians, not because they didn't like Brazil, but because they thought five was plenty as far as the permanent members were concerned, having already conceded that the French and the Chinese, as well as the big three at the time, had to be there. But it's become part of Brazilian diplomatic mythology, I think, that they nearly were permanent members at the opening of the at the San Francisco conference in 1945, but were sort of pipped at the post. Post-war, this sort of aspiration for great power status, I think, was sublimated to a degree, partly because of the global situation, the Cold War, partly because Brazil was going through a period of instability, both politically and economically. But it suddenly sprung up again with some force once Lula became president, and under his presidency we have seen since 2003 a fairly constant campaign by Brazil to be a permanent member of the UN Security Council, latterly a campaign in association with Japan, India and Germany. And it's still there and unresolved. But I put it there just to say the aspiration has been a sort of thread through Brazilian history and is still there. Now, as I said at the beginning, scale, predisposition, aspiration is fine, but to actually achieve something, you've also got to have some underpinning substance, and you've also got to have some opportunities. And what I'd like to go on to say is that in many ways Brazil over the last 20 or 30 years has been very lucky in this context, and has managed to establish itself politically and economically in a good state at the right time. They were luckily, in a sense, because in 1985, a period of 20 years of military rule, dictatorship, authoritarian military rule, shall we say, came to an almost natural end at about the same time as the Cold War came to an end. So as the structures of global alliances and global governments started loosening up post-Cold War and began to change, and as globalization was, as a result, economic globalization and political globalization was beginning to kick off, Brazil was actually in a position where it was changing economically and politically in ways which enabled it to, if you like, catch the wave of both of those things. Politically, it was clearly moving to consolidate democracy and democratic institutions after a period of 20 years of military rule, which they did remarkably successfully. And why was that important? Well, Brazil is not China. And I think for them, democracy was important both as a kind of, to provide domestic coherence to what they were doing and what they were trying to do, and cohesion, and also to provide sort of greater international acceptability to others as they tried to exert greater influence abroad. And then at the same time, they were beginning in strong ways to do their economic homework. It's another little known fact, it was little known to me until a few years ago, that actually between 1930 and 1980, on average, Brazil was one of the very fastest growing countries in the world. But they went through all kinds of political ructions in the course of this, and their economic growth was always subject to bouts, to external economic shocks and bouts of inflation, hyperinflation, domestically. But with the end of military dictatorship, they were beginning to move from a system of very inward-looking autarky, which did them some good, towards a much more outward-looking, open, somewhat more liberal economic system. To address the issues of instability and inflation, they had a series of currency reforms, which ended with the most important, the Real program in 1994. And it's absolutely fascinating. If you look at the graph of inflation before that and afterwards, that inflation just was way up. It was, you know, I can't remember, 20-30% a month. And it just fell straight down a cliff, and it has stayed somewhere, you know, who knows, somewhere lower than 10%, and currently at about 5 or 6% beyond that. It was a fantastically successful currency reform, which propelled the finance minister, Cardoso, to be president next time round. And he was taking over from his predecessor, but also passing on to his successor, one of the architects of the more general liberalization of the Brazilian economy. But perhaps the crucial point in that process in political terms came during the 2002 election, which was the election where Lula was running for president for the fourth time and eventually succeeded, and was running on a somewhat left-wing, anti-IMF program until the currency markets globally began to react very strongly against that. And in the middle of the election campaign, he sent a so-called letter to the Brazilian people saying, no, I've seen the light. I will pursue the policies which the IMF imposed on us, if you like, in order for the loans. We will have a responsible fiscal policy, and we will have a strict monetary policy. And in a sense, not only did he carry those things out in his 8 years as president, but actually what he did was removed the main aspects of economic policy from political contention. And that was a hugely important for Brazil's continual progress that he did that. And finally, in the list of things they've done right economically, one shouldn't forget they actually have had some really very smart and very good debt management since 2003, to the extent that at some considerable cost they domesticized, brought onshore most of their government debt, paid off all their foreign government debt, and because of the export boom, they actually end up now with foreign exchange reserves, which used to be zero and are now 275, 280 billion, which is a nice buffer against those external shocks which used to knock them off, or knock them off course so frequently. So to sum that up, I'd just like to say that I think Brazil is one of the great winners from the process of globalization which has been going on over the last 20 years. And you have to ask yourself, why is that? Well, I think it's because Brazil actually produces what the world needs. It's a huge food producer, and that is not going to be, the demand there is not going to be less. It produces minerals, as I've said. It's got a very clean so-called energy matrix. It produces clean energy and knows about biofuels, and it's got water. And eventually, water will be a huge either economic factor or tradable commodity. A bit difficult to see how water can be traded heavily, but the products which are produced with water may well be traded heavily because some parts of the world have it and some don't. And so, because it produces those things, and because it had got its economic house in order, Brazil was actually able to ride the commodities boom which came with globalization and the rise of China in a fantastically propitious and beneficial way for itself. And at the same time, which is interesting in the context of the recent global financial crisis, to diversify its export destinations away from a huge dependence on Europe and North America to, in particular, China, but the countries of Asia and, to a degree, to Africa. And politically, having done that homework post the end of the military regime in 1985, Brazil was somehow also able to profit from the shifting of the sort of global tectonic plates of power which went on then. It was able to sort of get onto the plates which were shifting in a positive direction with the rise of China and India. Because it had manifestly got its political and economic act together and was becoming to be economically powerful, because in a number of areas it was actually key to big negotiations which were going on, such as trade policy, such as the continuing climate change negotiations. And I think also because in the world of worrying about the environment and sustainable development, the Brazilians are crucial because of their endowments. And if you can't get sustainable development right in Brazil, then they're not going to do it anywhere else. So they are very influential within that sphere, as we saw from the original Rio Sustainable Development Conference in 1992 and the Rio Plus 20, which is happening next year. And as I've hinted, they were therefore in a position within the global power structure, but also within more mundane ways within the multilateral organizations to benefit from the relative decline of influence of Western countries, which I think received a huge impetus with the global financial crisis. And the symbol of that, if you like, was that suddenly, in the midst of the GFC, had to be conjured into substantial being the G20 at heads of state level, which had only ever before that existed at finance minister level, in order to become what it probably is now, which is the major deliberating, if not decision-making body as far as global economic situation is concerned. So, Chairman, with your indulgence, if I may, I want to say briefly something about the future and something about implications for British policy of this. As you know in your, from your sheet, if not before, there's a lovely saying which the Brazilians say about themselves, is that Brazil is the country of the future and always will be. In other words, future postponed, aspirations not realised. Well, but in brief, I think economically in Brazil the future has arrived. Growth is sustainable at 5 or 6%. Inflation is under control. They have huge external reserves, as I have said. There are some choppy winds which they have to go through at the moment, like everybody does, but they're not as choppy as the winds we're going to, seas we're having to go through. They've had a deficit of infrastructure, but there are huge infrastructure investments going in now, partly impelled by the World Cup, which is coming their way in 2014, and the Olympics in 2016, but they have a program of something like $130 billion worth of infrastructure investment between now and 2014, along with $180, $190 billion of oil and gas investment between now and 3 years' time, a four-year program. And so I think the future is that they will continue to be a global provisioner, but something we don't really have time to go into. I think they will also, just as, if you like, China is becoming the workshop, or has become the workshop of the world, and if you like, India has become the IT centre, the service centre of the world. I think Brazil's plus point, the point where they actually have advantages over everybody else, the unique selling point is probably to become a centre of everything which is to do with bio industries, biofuels, bioplastics, biorefineries are sort of coming down the track, and they have all it takes to do that. Assuming I'm right, and the future is pretty rosy, and assuming I'm right and that Brazil does become a more important power, just one word about what kind of major power they were likely to be in political and economic terms. And I think that's easily summed up by saying that they, when you talk to them about it, have an aspiration to be what they say, a sort of, quote, different kind of major power, a different kind of permanent member of the UN Security Council, by which they mean relying on soft power, not hard power, relying on negotiation, not coercion, and by which they mean that they would be firmly multilateral and continue to be concerned about intrusions on sovereignty. And therefore, if you like, they are likely to be a status quo power which wants to change the system but doesn't want to fundamentally throw it out and replace it with somebody else. So evolutionary and not revolutionary. Likely to be consensus-driven and moderate, and they're likely to be an upholder of multilateral institutions and the rule of law. Whether, down the track, this will lead to them actually wanting to develop a bit more hard power, a military, naval presence in the South Atlantic, I think is something for quite a long way down in the future, but it's entirely possible, but sort of, I think, off the present radar screen. So, implications for British policy, and then I'll better wrap up. I think the first one is the most obvious one. You know, the world is changing. It's not going to stop changing. And therefore, we better adapt to it as this country. And in particular, we better find out where we fit in within this new world order. Because I'm not sure we've actually begun, in a serious way, that kind of conversation, that kind of investigation into how are we going to fit into this, how are we going to maintain influence if we want to, and how are we actually going to maintain the standards of living which we've become accustomed to in a world where we have much less influence and levers of power than we've had previously. It started, but I think we need to go much more. My second, more specific qualification is just, let's continue building more substantial bilateral relations with countries like Brazil and the other BRICS. And this can't, trade is important, but it can't just be trade. And we have to understand what things they also want from us, which might be investment, it might be access to capital markets, it might be technology and know-how, it might be scientific and technical collaboration and knowing how to do innovation properly and get that into the real economy. And it might also be things that we can share in trade policy, sustainable development, even non-proliferation. And perhaps the most important thing is implicit in that, that actually one has got to get out of a traditional mindset and into a new mindset, and with countries like Brazil, develop a relationship which is actually based not just rhetorically on partnership, but actually really is, and a relationship which is actually built on trust, not just on opportunism. And if we can do that, they will be great partners. If they believe that we are opportunistic or that we are being paternalistic, British, not sincere, then actually we're not going to build the kind of relationship that we need in order to find that position in the new constellation that we need. I'm sorry to have overrun. I will stop there.